Good morning, everyone. I'd like to open the May 7, 2015 meeting of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. Welcome to everyone this morning. We have a morning full of invasive species, so which we'll try and rid ourselves of. With that, I'm going to open an informational hearing on aquatic invasive species. Mr. Gallagher, who do we have up for this?
Well, speakers today will be Richard Whitman from the Governor's Office and Ryan Hoof, Oregon Invasive Species Council representative today. Is that right, Ryan? And Lisa DeBruckier, am I saying that correctly? Close enough?
Close enough.
From the Pacific Northwest Economic Region Aquatic Invasive Species Control Initiative, and Mark Siskma from the State Aquatic Nuisance Species Plan. Rick Boatner and Glenn Dolphin are here from the State Boat Check Program. They've been actively working the past couple of weeks with, four findings in the past 8 days of quagga mussel. So.
Very, very good. Well, we have several people who have been before us before and a couple of new folks. Like to ask Richard Whitman, please, to come up, and anyone else that you'd like to have join you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Brown's natural resource advisor. I think it the order of testimony would be better if you heard the informational hearing first and then ask us to come up and speak specifically to the bill that's before you, which is Senate Bill 209.
Very good. Appreciate okay. that suggestion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to invite up, please, Mark Siskma and Lisa DeBruckier. And I'm sorry if I butchered your name. I probably did. Thank you very much for your willingness to appear this morning, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much. For the record, Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Lisa DeBruckier, and I'm on contract with the Pacific Northwest Economic Region and Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission to develop a regional framework for dracinids in the Pacific Northwest. With me today is Mark Siskma, the director for the Center of Lakes and Reservoirs at Portland State University. And also talking with us will be Glenn Dolphin with the Oregon State Marine Board and Rick Boatner with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We'll all be discussing the regional framework, the State Aquatic Nuisance Species Plan, as well as Oregon's Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program. And then we've left time for questions and discussions as well. Many of you I know are familiar with zebra and quagga mussels and the tremendous ecological and economic threat they pose to the Pacific Northwest and other states in the United States. These are small bivalve mollusks. They attach to things with their abyssal threads, and they can occupy as many as, in a square meter, 700,000 of them in that space. They're pretty significant. They've done tremendous damage to a number of infrastructure facilities in other places in the United States. We are the only region in the country that does not have these invasive species, and we are doing our best to keep them out. This map just shows you the big red clumping around the Great Lakes is where these species were introduced into the United States, and you can see where they have since spread. We are becoming increasingly concerned because they're inching their way closer and closer to the Pacific Northwest. We're not sitting on our laurels as these continue to spread. There's a number of organizations throughout the country and specifically focused in the West and the Pacific Northwest that have been working very hard in a coordinated, interjurisdictional way to keep these species out. It includes groups like the Pacific Ballast Water Work Group, the 100th Meridian, Columbia River Basin Group, the Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Forces, and the State Invasive Species Councils. And I'm not going to go into any great detail on any of those, just to say that It does take a lot of cross-border coordination as well with Canada. We're working very closely with the provinces of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and British Columbia with their provincial AIS coordinators, as well as EIS coordinators in Montana, Wyoming, Oregon, Idaho, California, Nevada, Utah, and Washington. So it's a pretty big group. We've done a number of things. We've developed a regional Quagga Zebra Mussel Action Plan. We have convened all of the state and provincial AIS coordinators to develop standard definitions and protocols for addressing this species. And we've just had a number of workshops across the West in the last 5 to 8 years to continue to keep our guard up and ensure that we have the most appropriate and up-to-date technology and methods that we're using to keep them out. In addition to that, I wanted to specifically call out the Columbia River Basin, which is of great concern to us because of the work that Mark Sitzma and his group have done relative to monitoring. We've identified some high-risk areas within the Columbia River Basin in the Pacific Northwest that are particularly susceptible to an introduction of dracinids. And that's based a lot on water quality, calcium levels, pH, those types of things. What we've been doing is we've pulled together the hydropower manager facilities within the Columbia River Basin, and we've encouraged them and worked with them to do vulnerability assessments on their facilities to prepare them for an introduction. By going through that process, and you'll see that map in the upper right, we've been able to work with those facilities to bundle their vulnerability assessments, saving them considerable funds. By geographically bundling them and by bundling them by facility type. We're still not quite sure people really understand the full impact of an introduction of dracinids to these hydropower facilities. It will not only mean significant costs to the facilities themselves, but all of the irrigation pipes and infrastructure that goes from those facilities out to farmers, agriculture, and everyone else. It's huge. It's huge. And we're going to show you some pictures, and Rick has an example. When these things glom onto something, they completely close up those irrigation pipes, 100%. So our progress to date, we've had a significant number of regional accomplishments relative to prevention. We've got a number of working groups. We do practice sessions with each of the states. Just this last 6 months, we pulled together representatives from state and federal agencies in Washington and Oregon, brought them together in a room and said, "We now have dracinids. What are you going to do?" And they went through the complete exercise of who's on first, what permits do we need to have, et cetera. So we're similar to almost to interagency fire command type practice sessions. We're doing that kind of work. We're really focused on prevention, early detection and rapid response, and control and management. So as all this work has been going on, we've decided we really need to define what this regional framework is and how it functions. So our goal is to prevent an introduction, to prevent a spread once an introduction occurs, to improve our ability to detect an introduction, and to improve our rapid response when it does happen. The problem we've got in the Pacific Northwest that most other states in the country don't have is we have salmonids. And salmonids adds an extra layer of complexity to what we're doing because of all of the efforts that are underway to encourage and improve existing salmon stocks in the Pacific Northwest. Salmon are particularly susceptible to some of the chemicals that have been used in other parts of the country. And so we're working very hard with NOAA and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on an informal consultation to grease the skids for when an introduction does occur. We won't have those hiccups associated with salmonids. And that's not an easy task because, as all of you are aware, we have so many different salmonid stocks in so many different places on the West Coast. Another one of our goals, and we've been fairly successful to date, and when I say we, I say collectively as a Pacific Northwest, of creating an aware and informed public that they should clean, drain, and dry their boat before they move to another site. So we've been doing pretty good with awareness and education. We've got a great regional coordination approach with Canada and the United States. And we've been doing some pretty good research. Where we have fallen short is the pink box, and that is developing capacity and allocation of adequate resources. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. What are we spending right now? Well, right now, these states and a couple of these provinces are spending a little bit over $10.5 million a year on prevention efforts. Those efforts are associated with outreach and education and watercraft inspection and decontamination stations. It's a huge sum of money, but it pales in comparison to what the actual cost of an introduction would be. So how did we come up with this $500 million annual estimate? The provinces of Alberta and British Columbia conducted their own studies on what an introduction would cost. So they looked at water management infrastructure, golf courses, all types of irrigation, boat maintenance, drinking water systems, all of those things that would be affected by an introduction of Dracaenids. And they each put a price tag on those. In addition to that, the states of Idaho and Montana conducted their own studies as well. And so what we did is we looked across all of those provinces in our five Pacific Northwest states, and based on the similar types of facilities, hydropower, drinking water systems, et cetera, we were able to develop what we consider to be, and what has been supported by a task force that was led by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, a pretty good ballpark estimate of over $500 million a year to our states and provinces should this introduction occur and should these species become established. In other parts of the country where these species have become established, those costs have been transported onto the public. People that use water for irrigation, people that use water for drinking and consumption. That's how that has played out in other parts of the country. We do not want to have these species here for those very reasons. And I haven't even, and won't discuss at any great length, the ecological impacts and interruptions to our system should these become established. It's well proven in other states and in other parts of the country. So as you can see, we are a magnet for boats that exist and get put in water in other parts of the United States. Once they're in other parts of the country, they move those boats and they come to the Pacific Northwest, and that's a huge red flag for us. Not only recreational mom and pop boats, but big giant boats that are hauled commercially. Although the majority of the fouled boats that come to the Pacific Northwest come from Lake Mead and the Great Lakes, our biggest concern is the lower Colorado region. And the reason for that is this. When a boat comes out of the Great Lakes, it's generally out of the water for a long enough period of time by the time it gets to the Pacific Northwest that the Dracaenids that have been attached to the boat are dead. And a dead Dracaenid isn't a great threat to us. The boats that are coming out of the lower Colorado region tend to come to us in a very short period of time, a couple of days. And in that period of time, those Dracaenids are still alive, and that's why those boats pose the greatest threats to us. And so you can see those big red dots. That's the area of the country that we're most concerned about and where we've been encouraging containment at the source. And that's our best bet, our least expensive bet is containment at the source. If you can stop those boats where they are, clean, drain, and dry them before they go to other parts of the country, they won't infest other parts of the country. This chart is not meant for you to read in any great detail at all. I just want you to look at the second column of number of boats inspected. We're inspecting hundreds of thousands of boats as they leave infested waters and as they come into the Pacific Northwest. We're tracing their origin, and we know where they're going. I've got a couple of slides I want to show you that demonstrate the tremendous coordination that's been taking place with our friends in Canada and here in the Pacific Northwest. These are the watercraft inspection stations that are active or proposed for 2015. These are the stations that are active or proposed for 2015 that demonstrate we're trying to guard the perimeter, right? We're not really concerned about the border between Idaho and Oregon as much as we are concerned about the border between Idaho and Utah, right? We want to try and protect the perimeter and keep those boats from breaching that perimeter. It's still good to have internal stations because we're catching infested boats in those internal stations too. But our best bet is focusing on the perimeter. This map shows you the size of the dot is the size of the effort at each one of those stations. So the bigger the dot, the longer the station is open in terms of days and hours during the day. So you can see we're really trying to hit the perimeter pretty hard. And we just wanted to emphasize again, our goal here is to protect the Columbia River Basin. That is goal number one. And so you can see again those perimeter stations. And what this map is showing is that we have been trying to get WERDA funding, Water Resources Reform Development Act funds, to supplement the state funds that have been used in this effort. We're working very hard in Washington, D.C., with a number of congressional delegations in all of the western states and in Canada through PNWR and the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission to get this funding. It's been appropriated. There's $20 million that's been set aside, but it hasn't been given or put in any pot where we can actually extract those funds to match our state investments. We're hoping to get $4 million of that 20 within the next 2 years. But the clock is ticking. The dots are moving closer to the Pacific Northwest. And all I can tell you is we are collectively all doing the best that we possibly can. If we do get those WERDA funds, this is what our map is going to look like. We're going to put more dots out there, put more effort out there. Our Canadian friends are engaging at a much higher level now that they've had an introduction in provinces east of Alberta. And this last one I wanted to show you is, where are we finding these infested boats? So those are the stations where we're intercepting the most infested boats. And when you overlay that on the maps I just showed you, we're hitting those places really hard. I also want to mention, too, that while all of this is going on, there's several people out there that are just monitoring, that are checking all these lakes and waterways on a regular basis. We could do better by doing more monitoring, but right now we just don't have adequate funds to do more. It's important that we stay ahead of the curve in terms of the biology of this species and the technology to address their establishment as well as their spread. And so we're working with the Great Northern Landscape Conservation Cooperative. They're providing funding for a group that Mark's helping to spearhead to convene later this year to look back 5 to 10 years on what we identified as the highest research priorities for these species and take a look at that again and see if we're still on the mark and reevaluate and decide what are the highest priorities moving forward. This is significant because with all of the regional coordination that has taken place to date, to review that, ensure that everybody's on the same page in terms of where we should make strategic investments in research, that's really important so that we're just not shotgunning money out there on little efforts here and there. The other thing I wanted to point out is that we did get together with National Sea Grant, and they did a thorough analysis. They developed a model law for all of the states in the country that if you were to develop a law in your state to prevent the movement of aquatic invasive species, what would it look like if you had the best law on the books? So they created that law for all of the states, and then they went through every state's laws and they identified any weaknesses. Oregon right now has 75% of the core authorities that are suggested in the national law. And a couple of the deficiencies that they have, some of them are really minor. Oregon is in a very good place, I guess is what I could say to summarize that. So what are the priorities moving forward? We are seeking support for WERDA funds so that the over $10.5 million of state and provincial investments are matched by some federal dollars. And we're supporting mandatory decontamination of fouled watercraft at source water bodies. When those boats are leaving Lake Mead and Lake Powell in these federally managed waters, they should be decontaminated at the source because those costs are being borne by us in states that are not infested. We want to support reauthorization of the National Invasive Species Act. We need to add quagga mussels as injurious under the Lacey Act. And we want everybody to be on the same page in terms of the economic environmental threat that is posed to the Pacific Northwest. And so we did draft a Western Governor's Resolution. Again, it calls for decontamination at the source and those four bullet points that I just mentioned to you. And so moving forward, we're working again with Pacific Northwest Economic Region and others to make sure that key legislation is on the books, that we're adequately funded to address this issue in the Pacific Northwest, contamination at the source, et cetera. And on that note, I will turn it over to Mark Sitzma with the Center for Lakes and Reservoirs.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Sitzma. I'm the director of the Center for Lakes and Reservoirs at Portland State University. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Oregon Aquatic Invasive Species Management Plan, which we put together several years ago. The plan was created really at the request of Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resources Cabinet back in 2000. We worked on the plan and developed it in 2001. It was approved by Governor Kitzhaber, submitted to the Federal Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force, and that results in some funding to implement the plan. Right now, the funding has been dropping over the years because there's only a certain size of the pie for this for state plans, and there have been more states that have come on board. So now it's down to about $20,000 a year. So it's not a lot of money to implement a plan. But we've managed to leverage that funding pretty significantly over the years. So that you can see the elements of the plan are its coordination, prevention, early detection, control, outreach and education, and research. So the plan has several of those elements. The budget, when we put this plan together back in 2001 to fully implement all the tasks that are in the plan, was something like $2 million a year. So we get $20,000. So obviously we're falling somewhat short of what our goal was when we put the plan together. But like I mentioned, we have leveraged those funds and done quite a lot of work in the past 14 years or so. So I'll just cover some of the past activities that we've worked on. Originally, we worked on a lot of outreach and education just to raise awareness of invasive species in the state, particularly aquatic invasive species. We have a volunteer Lake Watch program we have volunteers around the state that monitor specific lakes and identifying invasive species. That program was originally funded by DEQ, and then the funding lapsed, and then the Oregon State Marine Board picked it up a few years ago. So that's been rejuvenated. We make a lot of brochures, that sort of thing. We don't do so much of that anymore because we've produced a lot of paper over the years, and I'm not sure how effective that is in generating awareness, but we do have a lot of material available for people. We worked with DEQ. I should back up and say, you know, Portland State doesn't have any authority to implement anything. We're sort of a coordinating, implementing body of the plan. So we work with various agencies to actually implement the program. So originally, one of the first things we did was work with DEQ on a ballast water program. For many years, we worked to get a ballast water program established in the state at DEQ, and then we supported that program working hand in hand with DEQ in terms of monitoring ship data and logging data for DEQ until the program was actually funded by the legislature. Thank you very much. We also worked with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Marine Board in developing a zebra quagga mussel early detection and rapid response plan for the state of Oregon that sort of matches with the regional plan in the Columbia Basin that Lisa mentioned. We developed a feral swine action plan for ODF&W. So feral swine, okay, they're not very aquatic, but they do impact aquatic systems, and they get into stream wetlands and stream riparian areas and root around and destroy them. So we stretched the definition a little bit, but it was something that needed to be done, and so we put that plan together. That plan is now being used by USDA Animal Control Services to actually access some funding, so they got to like $250,000 a year to implement feral swine control programs in Oregon based on our plan. I work a lot with Oregon Department of Agriculture on aquatic weeds. I'll talk more about that in a few minutes. I want to focus on that a little bit. But I want to mention also the regional coordination. A lot of the regional activities that Lisa mentioned actually were instigated from our plan. So many of those organizations up there that coordinate things regionally had their initial meetings at Portland State that really grew out of our state plan. So some of the current activities right now, we're using our limited funds to support the Invasive Species Council. We're funding an external review of council operations. The council has been in existence for 14 years or something like that. It's never had a review, so we're looking at processes and activities of the council to see if they can be improved. We have a gap in our coordinator, so we're supporting an interim coordinator for the council. We are working on invasive tunicates on the coast and Japanese tsunami marine debris. problems with marine debris bringing invasive species in. Most of that work is through Oregon Sea Grant. So I mentioned, there's a lot of activity in various organizations in the state, and Sea Grant and the Invasive Species Council are very important players in that. Some of our current activities focused on aquatic weeds. You're going to hear a lot about mussels. I want to just bring you up to speed on some aquatic weed issues that we've been dealing with for many years and I think are a big gap in our program at this point. One of the first things we did working with Oregon Department of Ag was develop a Spartina management plan for the state. Spartina is an invasive plant that grows in mudflats and in estuary systems. And it can form meadows and cover up the mud flats, and that's an environmental and economic impact on the state. So our California and Washington had very extensive infestations. We didn't have very much, so we put together this plan in 2007 that includes early detection efforts and rapid response, which is basically the two key things for that, for controlling this infestation. That was a successful plan. I'll show you some of the results of that in a minute. But that was successful, so the West Coast Governors Alliance on Ocean Health formed a Spartina Committee because it's a coastwide problem and it really needs to be dealt with coastwide. So our plan was the basis for the coastwide plan by the West Coast Governors Alliance. And then Alaska liked our plan, so we actually developed a similar plan for Alaska. So we have the whole coast covered, except for Canada. On Spartina. There's just some examples. Spartina has a potential $40 million impact on the state through impacts on both fish and wildlife and on aquaculture activities in the state. So we spend a very, very small fraction of that, maybe a few thousand dollars a year, in early detection efforts. And so what you see here is examples of some of those early detection efforts in Coos Bay, Siusla Estuary, and the Columbia Estuary. So we cover the whole coast. And what you're looking at here, particularly the one on the right, this was my technician who was surveying the Siusla Estuary and found one plant and went, got her shovel and dug it up. So that's what I call early detection, rapid response.
Really rapid response.
And this, it's similar on the left side. That's an ODA employee, Glenn Miller, who found a few plants of Spartina densiflora in Coos Bay and just they dug them up and took care of the problem. The center picture is a stand. That's a large stand of Spartina in Oregon that we discovered through working with the Coast Guard. We do aerial surveys. The Coast Guard lets us get in their helicopters when they're flying the coast, and we look for Spartina while they're looking for boats that are floundering and that sort of thing, whatever they do when they're flying around. That larger stand was taken care of. That's Glenn Miller there spraying it. That was taken care of just within a few months after we discovered it, and it was completely eradicated in 2 years. So I think the Spartina plan is really an excellent example of an early detection rapid response program. We do a lot of freshwater aquatic plant surveys. This is just some of them. This map is a little bit dated. There are a lot more spots up in the northeast corner of the state now than and on the coast than you see on this map. But I point out that we have a few areas that are fairly impacted by aquatic invasive plants, particularly on the coast. But we have also a lot of water bodies in the state that are that don't have any. So we have a lot of really pristine aquatic plant communities, which are important for habitat for fish in the state, and they need to be protected from spread of these invasive species in elsewhere in the state. Here's just an example of some of the plants that we're working on right now that we're concerned about. Flowering rush is you can see in the map on the upper right, the red dots are sort of the distribution of this plant in the Columbia Basin up until last year when we found it just downstream of the Yakima River entrance into the Columbia on the Oregon side of the river. So the lower right shows you what it looks like in Flathead Lake. It forms very dense meadows basically in water up to 20 feet deep sometimes. So quite productive plant. So we discovered it, and immediately ODA, Washington Department of Ag, and PSU put together a coordinated response plan for that. So that's in place now. So again, it's an example of some of the coordination that we do with the other agencies to manage these problem species. Another one closer to home here in the Willamette Valley is water primrose. Very extensive infestations in the upper Willamette Basin. It's not nearly as widespread in the lower basin, but it grows in the backwater areas on the Willamette, which of course is important salmonid and other species habitat, Oregon chub habitat. And basically when it covers the surface like that, it reduces dissolved oxygen and light, and it makes the habitat unavailable. So another example of coordination is this Western Aquatic Invasive Species Network that's really a group of people in the Willamette Valley that have come together to sort of focus on this particular plant. So there's a lot of players and activity out there, and sometimes it's hard to keep on top of all of them. So in the future, this is sort of where I see our invasive species plan going. We need more detection, early detection, rapid response. So Lisa mentioned we do a lot of monitoring for zebra and quagga mussels. We do quite a bit for aquatic weeds, not nearly as much as we do for mussels. But there are other species like crayfish and lots of other species out there that we should be looking for. We anticipate doing additional management planning for particular species. We provide technical assistance on management. We're at a university, so we like to do research on the biology, ecology, and management options for these species. We're doing a lot of that right now for quagga mussels. And I think we need some further development of an aquatic weed program in the state to address some of the problems that I brought up here. So that's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger.
Well, you've already got them. Is there water treatment that you can use to relieve them? Are there groups that are opposing that treatment, taking you to court, possibly to try to keep you from able to do it?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Krieger, there. Once the mussels are established in an open system, it's difficult to control them. There have been some instances where, under certain circumstances, they have been eradicated. There was just a report yesterday I saw about a lake in Minnesota where they used a product called Zequinox, which is a dead bacterium that they put in the water and presumably eradicated these mussels from a lake in Minnesota. So typically, it would be a very constrained area, and they would put a curtain around it so to isolate it from the rest of the water body and then just treat that area. Potash has been used to eradicate mussels in a gravel quarry back east. So again, it's a very isolated system, so you could put some chemicals in there and take care of it. But in an open system like the Columbia River, it would be very difficult to do. In terms of resistance, I think there will probably likely be resistance to chemical control efforts, although some of the work that Lisa's done regionally to sort of engage those people that might have some regulatory control over pesticide applications to get them on board and sort of pre-approve some treatment methods so we don't get delayed, because the delay is the problem.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But this is kind of like we aren't just fighting one front, we're fighting 10 or 15 different fronts. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how this is going to develop, because, you know, you have the aquatic species, you have the not only the plants but the mussels and things of this nature. You have local people dumping things into the ecosystem that affects it. You have feral hogs coming up. They're as far as Burns, Oregon now. You have birds that are, and I'll give you a great example, starling. Very devastating. You have so many different avenues. I guess you've got 10 holes in the dike, or you have 11 holes, and you have 10 fingers. Well, I mean, what do you, how do you go about this? Because like that thing in Flathead Lake, I've been to Flathead Lake, it's huge. But how do you take care of that?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, you're right. There are lots of threats. I think some of the efforts we do have multiple benefits. So the boat inspection program you're going to hear about, I mean, that's not only stops mussels. They are also looking for weeds. So that one effort has multiple benefits in terms of species control. I think certainly we have a lot of invasive species that have been established. And that's a control program. So you're just mitigating the impacts, like a lot of aquatic weeds on the coast. I mean, if it's around somebody's dock, a whole lake full of aquatic weeds, but somebody can't swim at their dock, we can't treat the whole, doesn't make sense to treat the whole lake, but we can solve the problem right around the dock for them. So for those established species, really the solution is a control program and research on biocontrol. Because when a species is that widespread, really the only way to get it under control is some sort of biocontrol agent that you could develop. So there's a lot of work on biocontrol agents in Europe right now for that flowering rush plant that I mentioned that's in Flathead Lake. It's very widespread. It's continually coming downstream. So we need to sort of find those satellite populations to prevent them from becoming established downstream, and at the same time be working on a biocontrol program to attack the source population. That would be my strategy for dealing with these species.
Please. When we do the control of these species, what effect does that have on the lake itself? Because I'm sure that has to change something in the lake, whether it be the pH factor or something, because you're putting an additive. You're evidently you're doing this with chemicals, I assume.
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar. For our weeds, the control chemical control for weeds has gotten much more sophisticated over the years. So there are selective herbicides, so you can go in and take out specific weed species and leave native species with minimal impact on the system as a whole. For mussels, it's more difficult because mussels are animals, and some of the species, these iconic species that we have in the lake, are animals too, and so they're susceptible to sort of similar control methods. But with, again, I mentioned we need additional research on control methods, and that's really aimed at that, is how can we selectively remove these species? I mentioned this dead bacterium that's been used in a lake in Minnesota to control zebra mussels. That's an example of a very specific control technique. It's not a chemical, but it's a product that you can add to the water to, and it only kills zebra and quagga mussels. So it leaves the native mussels untouched. So there are techniques and methods that have been developed to sort of specifically address certain species without having that sort of lake-wide, system-wide impacts that you're referring to.
Well, please, is it not against the law in the state of Oregon to transfer or transplant any species in from one lake to another today? Isn't that against the law?
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar.
We have people that do that all the time. since I've been a kid, which has been a long time ago, I understand that, but we've I think poisoned Hyatt Lake three times in my lifetime so far, because people put different species in those lakes. They bring in catfish, panfish, stuff like this, and pretty soon it gets to the point where they have to just eradicate it all and start over.
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar, I think that's where the education program comes in. I mean, we've been working on that for years. I think we've raised awareness of the damage that those kind of activities can have, and we need to keep that up. Oregon Sea Grant has a really great educational programs that address a lot of these kind of problems. You can't prevent everybody. You can't prevent 100% of people from doing, things that they shouldn't be doing. In answer to your question, I believe it is illegal, although somebody from ODF&W can probably answer that question more authoritatively than I can about the legality of actually moving species around. But I know, I believe it is illegal for people to do that.
No, Mr. Chair,
yes.
It actually costs taxpayers, I think, $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 just to take care of Diamond Lake with the chewy jet.
More than that.
Yeah. Pretty
$5 million or something like that.
Is that what it was?
$5 million.
Pretty significant.
I knew it was a ton of money. And what's sad about it is we had to kill the whole lake.
Well, and we lost our fishery while we were waiting for it to grow back too. Yeah. So, Representative McEwen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Witt. I just wanted, on the record, thank both of you for the good work you're doing in this area. It's so incredibly important, and I think it's the education piece, continuing to raise awareness for all of our citizens and the people coming into this state is just something that we cannot lose sight of. And I had a couple of questions. I'm happy to be sponsoring the Senate Joint Memorial asking that the federal government appropriate the money through WERDA. And it Is some of that money going to be dedicated to this research that you're looking for ways that we can find to do some eradication methods? And then I have another comment.
Chair Witt and Representative McCune, yes, a portion of it can be. The majority is slated to be dedicated for watercraft inspection and decontamination stations, which also includes education and outreach. But we're encouraging the use of a good portion of it for research and monitoring.
Great. Great. And I also have been privileged to be attending the PennWorks conferences where the invasive species work is being done at a different level, the cross-border issue, which is also very, very important. And I appreciate your work there. I know that the Western States Governors Conference has this as a priority, and I know that Governor Kitzhaber was very involved in this conversation, and I hope we're able to encourage Governor Brown to become highly involved in this conversation as we move forward, because I think for this committee, this has to be a priority of the work that we do in this legislative session, because so much is at risk from everything that you have explained, that I think a lot of us already know, but we have a whole lot of folks out there who don't understand this issue and need to very clearly understand this issue and the threat that it poses on so many fronts. So thank you so much for your good work, and thank you for such a comprehensive presentation today. This was very, very informative. And we're grateful that you're here.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you very much. I want to echo Representative McEwen said. This is outstanding. Your work is really outstanding. I'm also concerned because we've done this. We have done this before. We've seen this kind of thing. We have an extinct lamprey that was destroyed in the 50s. In Oregon, went in, took out a complete lake because it was a native lamprey to Oregon, but it's now extinct because we had to deal with invasive species of one form or another at that particular time. So this is a concern, and we need to know what we actually have available and how these invasive species are affecting not just the clogging of pipes and other things, but also how they're affecting the other species in the state. So I appreciate the work that you're doing. We've seen what happens in the Midwest and the Southwest when we don't do something about it. So again, thanks again.
Vice Chair McLean.
Well, all the compliments, I'll just say ditto to those, but I really wanted to say that as I watched and listened to you, it sounds like you've worked on this for many, many years, and it seems really important that we have some other institutions like Oregon State and yourself looking for young people to follow you, because the research aspects of this seem like it will go on forever. And it sounded to me, as you were talking about how do we solve this, of course we have to do the short-term important inspections, but the long-term effects and the long-term research is probably the only thing that will help us not have that reoccurrence of these types of issues. So I hope you're out there pursuing your programs and trying to find young people that like to do the same things you like to do.
Representative Witt and Vice Chair McLean, yes, we are. Sam Chan is back here with Oregon State University. He fosters lots of students. Mark Sitzma does, his counterpart, Kat de Rivera, at Portland State University. There's folks all over the Pacific Northwest, the United States, and globally dealing with this issue. And we're all working with people a whole lot younger than us on a daily basis. So thanks.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I see on this issue is it's a very difficult fight. But if you change one species in an ecosystem, you change the whole system. I don't care what that species is. Representative Frederick talked about an eel that had to have changed the ecosystem in that particular lake or whatever it was. Okay. I guess that's the worst thing I can think of is getting into a river like the Rogue River or getting into a lake and completely changing. I've seen what they've done in the Great Lakes with zebra mussels, and it's changed the whole system is what it's done. So I have some very great concerns, and I'm pleased to see that we're at least reacting to this. We've got a plan in place, but I think it's up to us as legislators to fund what we need to fund in order to protect it.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. And Representative Esquivel, you just opened the door to another comment I was thinking about making. And I know that, you know, we're requesting this federal money from through WERDA. And I know that we're making a local investment in our states and western provinces are. But if the WERDA money is not forthcoming, where do we as a legislature fit into this funding picture? If you were king and queen of the world, are we adequate in what we're doing in protecting our borders? I'm serious. Are we doing enough?
Well, Representative Witt and Representative McEwen, we can never do enough in terms of invasive species or outreach and education. I mean, we do what we have with the capacity that we have. And if we had $20 million, we'd be quadrupling our effort. If we had $50 million, we'd be X. So the bottom line is we feel like with an additional $2 to $4 million of WERDA funds, we could plug gaps in our watercraft inspection and decontamination stations, particularly in the perimeter locations of the Pacific Northwest. So what we're trying to do is prioritize, knowing it isn't unlimited funds. We may get one, we may get two, we may get $4 million, and we may ultimately end up with 20. But regardless, we will have consensus in the Pacific Northwest and Canada on how those funds will be spent. And that's our goal, is to make sure that moving forward, it's not a grab, that it's a coordinated, comprehensive, prioritized, strategic effort.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So these decontamination stations, would they be like on the border, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. just like you come into California and they check you for fruit? If you had these, you know, why couldn't you just, if you bring your boat into the state, you have a toll for that, you know, rather than getting the dollars from the state or from the feds, you know, it's subject to those bringing their boats in.
Chair Witt, Representative Barreto, you're actually segueing into the next part of the program, which is our two experts on watercraft inspection and decontamination, so it might be good for us to fall back and give Glenn and Rick a chance to share with you the details of how they're implementing it on the ground.
Additional questions? I too want to thank you for the critically important work that you do in holding off ecological and economic disaster. And I think as Representative Frederick pointed out, when we begin to lose species, I don't think we understand the potential for adverse social impacts too with the loss of these species and what that means to us as a society. So with that in mind, what is it that you see that we as a committee could be doing to assist you in your efforts? Now, I noticed that we're about 25% deficient on our state's statutes and the coverage provided there with respect to the model language from the feds. I suspect there may be other things that we could do in terms of programs, those sorts of things. What do you see? What is folks who are out there on the front lines, what kind of help is it that you need?
Chair Witt, I think we need to support state natural resource agency budgets. I think we're underfunded relative to other state agencies as a state in terms of our commitment to natural resources, particularly given the breadth and scope of the natural resources that we have in this state. And so, you know, Oregon Department of Agriculture's weed and insect programs, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife programs, all of these state agencies that have less than 1% of the entire state's budget. And we acknowledge that in a society where we're dealing with elderly and schools and all of those things that are competing interests, that's a reality. But the reality, too, is that the health of our citizens is based on the health of our state's natural resources. And so if it were one thing and we were king and queen for the day, we'd probably say greater support for the state's natural resource agency budgets. No, I'm not speaking for you, Mark. But just for that minute.
Chair Witt, I'd just add some of these questions about resilience of systems, about how many species you can take out or add, those are really important research questions that we don't have the funds to really address. But we need to know which species are the most dangerous, because we have some non-native species that have been introduced that haven't caused any problem. But we don't know which ones those are. We don't know which traits that those species have that are going to be the most damaging. So coming from a university, I have to put a plug in for some research, because there are these important questions that need to be examined and answered. And so I'd like to see some support for that sort of effort.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've always felt for quite some time, since it's been 6-8 years ago that I went to a seminar on invasive species in Alabama, and I've always felt that we talk the talk in Oregon about our state, but yet we really haven't put the effort and the monies into our effort, and I think it's time that we need to. Example, the sage grouse we have. We have a species that's in trouble, so now it's up to us to correct that, to help correct it. And invasive species, I don't think we stopped boats until about 6 years ago, I think, something like that. And it was because we started talking about it. It's so easy for people to contaminate a ecosystem. I remember a guy that threw his aquarium, just emptied it in a lake in Georgia, I think it was. And no species in it other than that scraggly little plant that you put in your aquarium. And then they showed the picture of the lake. You couldn't get your boat to the dock because of this stuff. It completely took over the lake. You could almost walk on that lake. So those are the kinds of issues we have to educate the public on, and more importantly, we have to be very watchful of our borders. And doesn't matter what the feds do, I wouldn't rely upon the federal government. I would worry about what we need to do.
See no further questions. Thank you both so very, very much for your excellent testimony. We appreciate very much your appearance. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Ryan Hoof, Rick Boatner, and Glenn Dolphin.
I'll show you.
Look at that, isn't that appetizing? I'm going to hold off, I think. Okay, very good. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee.
These snacks.
Morning. Thank you. For the record, I'm Glenn Dolphin, Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator for the Oregon State Marine Board. I'm going to give a quick overview of the state prevention program as we have it in place. I'm going to primarily focus on the funding that we receive and how we distribute those funds and some of the education and outreach materials that we've produced. And then Rick Boatner will talk about our inspection station. As some of you probably recall, or most of you perhaps, back in 2009, the legislature created the program that Rick and I will outlay for you. That particular year saw a lot of invasive species legislation pass, and the Invasive Species Council was extremely excited and grateful for that. The boat permit program that I'll talk a little bit more in detail about was created in 2009 and a slight update in 2011. What I commonly call the Clean Launch Law, which states you cannot launch your boat in the state of Oregon unless it's clean of any aquatic species, was created. It's illegal to knowingly transport aquatic invasive species in the state. And the boat inspection program was created. Now, when that first started, it was a voluntary stopping authority given to the state. That didn't work very well. Not very many people stopped. And in 2011, the legislature worked with us to create a mandatory stopping authority. So the program's funded by boat permit fees that were new in 2009, started in 2010. On the left there, you can see that we have a non-motorized boat category. So any non-motorized boat 10 feet or longer is required to purchase a permit and carry it with them when they're on Oregon waters. Both of the agencies sell a version of the permit, gives the public more options on where to purchase it. So the Marine Board sells Tyvek Tag, a 1- and 2-year version, and Department of Fish and Wildlife sells a paper permit out of their point-of-sale system at their licensing businesses around the state. Those businesses can add a $2 agent fee to the transaction for those permits. Outfitter and guide businesses and rental businesses called liveries pay into the system as well. And based on how many boats
Representative McEwen has a question.
I just have a clarification.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about a non-motorized boat over 10 feet, a paddleboard is considered a non-motorized boat and would require a tag. Is that correct?
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen, a stand-up paddleboard has been determined by the Coast Guard and the Marine Board to be a boat.
Great.
And so they must comply with all state boating law.
I have a number of paddleboarding friends who need to be educated on that fact, so I just wanted to get it on the record for all of my paddleboarding friends. Thank you.
You're welcome. So the rental businesses we call liveries, and then outfitter and guide businesses that take the public out on trips can apply for discounted permit rates based on how many boats they own. In-state Oregon registered motorboats, the far upper right, when you register a motorboat in the state of Oregon and you get a 2-year registration, you pay a permit fee with that. And then any non-resident bringing a motorboat into the state to recreate in Oregon waters must buy a permit, and that's a $20 annual permit. Again, Marine Board and Fish and Wildlife. One thing to note as well is that the Marine Board does offer these permits for sale on the internet through our website as well. So you may be asking, you know, how many permits do we sell and what kind of revenue comes in? So the AIS Prevention Fund was also created in the 2009 legislative session. It's administered and managed by the Marine Board. It's established in state treasury, but it's separate and distinct from the general fund. So it's what's commonly called a dedicated fund. And so any unused funds do roll over from one biennium to the next. And for the 2014 fiscal year, our most recently completed fiscal year, you can see the different categories of boats, the permits, and how many permits were sold in those categories. One thing to note is the motorized Oregon motorized number is probably about half of the boats that we register in the state. We at the agency split up the statewide boats in half and register one half 1 year, the other half the other year for their alternating 2-year cycles. And then you can see from 2011 to 14 what our revenues have been for the program. Unfortunately, they've slightly declined. We believe that's contributing to the, it is contributed to the loss of less boats being registered every state with this, every year with the state. Distribution of funds. So the Marine Board has those funds, and we look to our partners to implement field work and do other work on behalf of the program in the state. So you can see the biggest piece of the pie is going to Department of Fish and Wildlife for their boat inspection program. That includes all the education and outreach that occurs to the public through that effort, invasive species management coordination. The universities do have in the past received a small amount of funding from the program for some projects that I'll show later. Our law enforcement agencies around the state, the county sheriff departments, the state police, fish and wildlife agency department, do receive a small amount of funds to help enforce the permit laws, as well as the clean launch law, and as well as the boat inspection stations themselves. They also act in an important education and outreach effort as well. They give far more warnings to boaters than they do citations, and they try and make sure people understand the program and why it's important to have your permit when you're boating in Oregon. The Marine Board, we use about 14% of the funds on an annual basis for our coordination, education and outreach efforts, and then just a small 3% of the overall budget's used to actually administer the the permits themselves. That would be the printing, the and the management of those in our fiscal department. So the message to boaters has been, for many years now, clean, drain, and dry your boat. This is a message that, as Lisa was talking about early, all of our efforts with the western states to coordinate has transferred over to a lot of states using the exact same message to boaters, and that was very deliberate in the fact that we know boaters travel from state to state, and if they were getting the same message in one state as they did another, then hopefully they would key in on what we're trying to ask them to do. So cleaning can be very simple or complicated depending on how dirty the boat is, but essentially it's just cleaning all aquatic plants, animals, and mud from boats. And then drain and dry, it's a fairly simple concept. You know, you're draining any standing water that a boat may have. You know, that includes a canoe as much as it does a ski boat. And then allowing your boat to dry, if possible, between uses, because that's another way for, if you weren't able to clean an aquatic species off your boat, if it was to dry out over a certain amount of time in the sun, then that species would perhaps die as well and not be able to survive a transport to a new location. So some of the signage that we have been using since 2010 when we first implemented the program to inform the public of what's going on is that when people drive into the state of Oregon on 20 of our major highways, they'll see a 10-foot by 5-foot sign that states there's a law required for a permit. ODOT was very cooperative with us to assist with the installation of those signs along the highways. At boat ramps, you'll see one of two different signs, perhaps sometimes both of them, but the larger 3-foot by 2-foot sign does talk about the state laws that are in place, the clean, drain, dry message, how to report invasive species to the state if you see them. And then the smaller 11 by 17 sign is been designed and has messages primarily for the non-motorized boaters at smaller access sites where the information is trying to be presented to them so they can comply with the state laws. The state AIS program has also funded over the last 5 years printed materials that we've tried to have out at, for instance, the businesses that sell licenses, the tackle shops and sporting goods stores. So we've got rack cards and brochures. At the inspection stations themselves, every boater entering receives a rack card at the minimum that you see there with information about why it's important to comply with clean, drain, dry, and that there's a permit program in Oregon that boaters would need to comply with before boating. Certainly these are not all of the publications that are out there. These are just a few that the state has helped to fund. Oregon Sea Grant compiled a really great field identification guide, that flip book up there at the top. We contributed some funds several years back to print those and get them out to the public. On the back of the Tyvek tag that the Marine Board sells as a permit, there's clean, drain, dry information about what we're doing. Department of Ag and Portland State University and ourselves have printed several aquatic weed cards for distribution at events to the public. And myself and Rick, the two agencies, compile together an annual report every year on this effort and all the details of what we're doing, how we're spending money, and the boat inspection effort. So lastly, I just wanted to touch upon some of the other projects over the last two bienniums that have been funded. So we have gotten some money to the universities, as I mentioned, so follow-up monitoring for New Zealand mud snails that are probably in about a dozen locations around the state, and we're trying to not see spread. Coastal marine invasions is an emerging management area for us. Not a lot of work has been done in our coastal regions on managing invasives, and we're trying to get a handle on what's there and how best to move forward on that. Eurasian water milfoil is an aquatic weed that we're trying to get better ideas on strategies for containment. As Mr. Sitzman mentioned, the Oregon Lake Watch program has been reborn. We also have given funds for zebra and quagga mussel monitoring in the state. We built a boat wash station at 10 Mile Lake a couple years ago, the first one in the state to be built, and it's received really great use from the public. We're using it as a demonstration project, and so we had
Portland State University interact with boaters at that facility and do some on-ground surveys on their interaction with that and their awareness levels, and got good data on that. And then lastly, there's an online Oregon Atlas of Lakes database, and that has been interfaced with aquatic invasive species information for the public to learn about at those. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rick for the boat inspection station.
Excuse me, before you start in, Vice Chair Krieger?
What are all the accesses that people have to get the permits in rural areas?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Krieger, I believe ODFW has approximately 500 businesses in the state that sell hunting and fishing licenses. Those point-of-sale systems all sell the permit out of the same computer. So I believe most small towns around the state have some tackle shop or sporting goods store that has the permits available.
I got to have one for my 10-foot pram.
I'm sorry, what kind of boat?
A little 10-foot pram.
Yep.
If it's 10 feet long, yeah. And as I mentioned, the Marine Board has online sales as well for the permits.
Okay. Good morning. For the record, I'm Rick Boatner, the Invasive Species Coordinator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. This morning, I'll talk to you about our inspection program in the state. Our program has two goals. One is to protect Oregon from the introduction of aquatic invasive species, and which is part of the conservation strategy plan that our agency works with. The other one is to educate everyone about aquatic invasive species. We use each inspection stop as an opportunity to educate the public, as well as going to schools and events to talk to people about invasive species and the aquatic invasive species program. Besides, at our inspection stations, granted zebra and quagga mussels, which in this display are the quagga mussels out of Lake Mead. The little baggie that went around, those were zebra mussels out of Lake Erie that we picked up on the first boat that we stopped this season. So we're mainly looking for zebra and quagga mussels. We're also looking for standing water in the boats, because the standing water can contain the veliger stage or the microscopic juvenile stage of quagga and zebra mussels, and they're viable in the water for many days from time they leave the water body. We're also looking for New Zealand mud snails. These are very small snails, size of a rice grain, that they have an advantage. They clone themselves, so it just takes one to start a population, and they can multiply very quickly in some water bodies as great as 500,000 per square meter, like in the Yellowstone system. Live bait we're looking for, and it's correct that you need a permit to transport live bait or live animals or to release them in Oregon. And so we're looking for live bait on these boats. Also, aquatic weeds. Some of the weeds that Mark talked about can multiply or reproduce by fragmentation. And so we're looking for sometimes little fragments on boats so we don't start populations other places. In 2014, we did roughly 11,500 inspections, close to 1,500 inspections in the state. And the X's represent where our check stations were in 2014. Central Point, or the Ashland Station, was our busiest one, and we did a little over 5,000 inspections there. And you'll see the number of 62. We count everything as a decon, and at that station, most of the decontaminations were due to plant material. They only intercepted two boats with quagga zebra mussels on them at that station. The Ontario station is our next busiest, with a little over 3,000 inspections. They intercept most of our boats with quagga and zebra mussels on them. Last year, they did 12 at that station. Again, the larger numbers also, they catch a lot of boats with plant material on them. Generally, Eurasian milfoils are the most common species we find on them. Gold Beach and Klamath and Lakeview, all are valuable. At Gold Beach, all of those stops were due to plant material, same as Klamath Falls last year. You notice Lakeview, we do not have a lot of inspections. 2 years ago, they actually intercepted two boats with quagga and zebra mussels at that station. So they're all very valuable, even though some years it's slower than others.
A couple of questions
Here.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Those that you intercepted that had the species on them, were they alive and viable, or were they dried out and dead?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger. Most of them are dead. Now, Quaggin's ear muscles are very difficult to tell if they're alive or dead. We generally, there's no test out there that we can instantly tell. So we assume, we always make the assumption they're alive. And our law states they can't be transported whether dead or alive. And so in the field, we do drop them in some water and see if they move. That's about the best test we have to determine. And we're also concerned, live mussels are a very concern to us if they get in, but also dead mussels due to DNA testing that we do in the water bodies. So the tissue gets in the water body, we have a false positive, and now we're treating the body of water as a suspect. So it takes more sampling later to verify that it's not positive. So,
please.
Those boats that you found, did you address the problem right there, right. Decontaminate them or what?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger. Yes, at each check station, our teams have a decontamination unit, which is a hot water pressure washer, and we have mats. So we decon the boat right on site using 140-degree water to kill them, and then we blast them off with the pressure, and then we release the boat after we tag it. And with a red tag to let it know it had been deconned. So if some of the other states sees it coming, they know we deconned it. We also, if the boat is going to a different state, like in Washington, we will notify Washington Fish and Game that we just deconned this boat here in Oregon, and you might want to check it in your boat. Because you can see these things are very small, and more eyes you have seeing, the more chance of finding something.
Okay.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I think Representative Krieger just asked the question I was going to ask.
Oh, okay.
What's the procedure when you find one? I had noticed that you'd found a contaminated boat about, 10 days ago or so, a couple weeks ago. And what's the process for the boat owner at that point? I think you've clarified it. So,
Representative Witt, Representative McEwen, the procedure is when we inspect the boat, once we find it, if we find one mussel, then the boat goes to decontamination. And for standing water, it's more based on our interview. If the boat owner says, you know, I was in Lake Mead, that makes it a higher risk boat, and we'll assume that the standing water has veligers in it. So we'll decon. So the standard procedure, once we get the boat in, we put them on the mat so we catch any of the runoff. A couple of places we're in isolated enough spots that we don't need the mats because they're not going anywhere. And then we start at one end of the boat below the water line, going slowly, deconning all the boat, the engine, any transducer, anything that's attached to the boat. We flush the engine with hot water, so we're killing anything in the veligers, because at the veliger stage, these quagga mussels and zebra mussels can get sucked up into the intakes, and they can actually grow inside the housing of an engine. So we flush that, as well as the interior of the boat, any biligery, live boats and stuff like that. And depending on the size of the boat, a standard boat's going to take you an hour. If it gets more complex, because it's a big pontoon boat, has lots of additionals like slides and stuff, it may take you 6 to 8 hours to decon a boat.
Wow.
And for Oregon, that's part of the cost of people buying the permit. So we don't charge for the decon or the inspection.
Great. Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you back up a slide, please?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have these points of entry, but what about the other points of entry out here? You know, we have two over there in Malheur County. You have some up in the Pendleton area. You have from Washington. Are those not a concern to us? Especially that one that comes from California, looks like, or Nevada. In the Far East.
McDermott.
Yeah, Chair Witt.
It's McDermott.
It's McDermott.
Yeah. Well, that's a hot place.
Yeah.
With the current staffing I have, this is the best we can do. I have my seasonal staff consists of 12 people for the whole program. We have moved a little bit, so in the perfect staffing, I'd like to have two people on duty at all times. At some of these, like Klamath Falls, we moved to one. At this year at McDermott or at Bask, we're going to have a I'm going to call it a roving check station because I could not hire anybody. Nobody wanted to go to Bask to work
or
for
McDermott,
the summer.
Yeah. That's a tough one.
So we are going to be doing an experiment there, setting up check stations there throughout the summer to see what we got moving. And we have concern because of Wild Horse and South Lake in Nevada. We also have 199 that cut off to Grants Pass from California. We don't have a check station, which is a concern there, too.
Yeah.
Redwood Highway.
Yeah.
Mr. Boatner, could you explain the procedure for a boat check? Does everyone have to stop, or do you just flag somebody over, or what's the process?
Chair Witt, by rule you guys passed in 2011, we have mandatory stopping authority. Right. And so we set up our signs. Anybody that passes, when the signs are up, if you pass, you must stop to be inspected. We also use with Marine Board, the county sheriffs, and Oregon State Police, we run blitzes at these check stations. So we have an officer there, all the time, but sometimes, that if anybody bypasses, they'll get pulled over, and in Oregon, it's a $110 fine. And since it was passed a mandatory stopping authority, we have a compliance rate of about 70% now. People stopping compared to when it was on a volunteer basis, we had about a 29% compliance rate. So it's improved drastically. Still has a ways to go to get up higher.
And of that 30% that fail their compliance, how many of those are chased down?
Chair Witt, when an officer's there, most everybody. Mm-hmm. We've had blitzes like at Ashland where we've had five officers, and we've had all five officers out at one time and still people bypassing. So it depends. Last year in Oregon, it was fortunate we did have the county sheriff just happened to be there, and our first boat of the season that went by was a commercial hauler, and he stopped and brought him back and had a discussion with him, and we deconned his vessel.
Very good. Thank you.
Any discussion with
him. Yes.
That.
Yes.
Please, please proceed.
Okay. Last year, due to staffing timing, the time we're opening at our check station is vastly changes drastically. The Brookings station, we only have a staff of two, so it's generally 5 days a week. These are hours. Sometimes towards the middle of the season, when my inspectors are more comfortable and know what more experience, we will divide them up, and so we're actually at coverage 7 days a week and more hours. The difficult with one person there, if you have a boat that comes in that you need decon, you got to close down so you can focus on the decon. So definitely I prefer to have two. At Ashland, we actually opened earlier last year with a two-person staff in February. And then when May, the boating season comes on, which is now starting in May, we added additional two people. And so we were able to open 7 days a week, 10 to 12 hours a day. Midland, which is actually Klamath Falls, right down the road. Again, it's a two-person staff, generally 5 days a week. Lakeview was a staff of one, so 5 days a week. In Ontario, we had three, and we staggering the shifts, we were able to keep it open 7 days a week and 10 hours a day. So that worked. Last year, as this shows, we inspected vessels from almost every state of the union. On this slide, the pink ones are states that have zebra and quagga mussels in them, and the yellows are the ones that have no quagga and zebra mussels. As you can see, the Pacific Northwest is clear right now, and a few other states. Like I said, just about every state was represented at the inspection station. I forgot to mention an earlier slide about, you might have noticed Salem, that we had three. In part of the, we work cooperatively with other states, and if like a boat comes into Needles and gets rejected, they will give us the paperwork and the phone number, and we will call the person and say, when you come to Oregon, we would like to inspect your vessel. And we got a vessel earlier this year in February before the check stations. That was due to that Needles rejected it. We phoned him. He lived in Portland, and we came up and deconned his vessel for quagga mussels.
Wow.
So the perimeter is important and the cooperation between the other states. These are what our inspection stations look like. The top one is Klamath Falls. That's a Midland rest area. The bottom left is the Golden Beach, or we actually it's at Brookings, at the weigh station there at Brookings. Our fancier one is the one at Ashland, at the point of entry in Ashland. And there we stay open. This year will be March till end of October. The middle one is Ontario Check Station, and that's one place we don't need to mat to lay down. It's hot enough and stuff, and we can decon right on the premises. And the bottom one is our Lakeview, and that's right on the border where you say, welcome to Oregon. We're right in front of the site. That's the only white spot in the road there. This is what we caught last year. Our intercepted 8 boats from the Great Lakes, 5 from Lake Pyle, 2 from Lake Mead, 1 from the Colorado system, 1 from Texas. Now, the 2 Atlantic Ocean, one was actually blue mussels, and the other one was a Conrad mussel, which is not native to our area. And Flathead, for some reason, we got a blue mussel out of air, which is a marine species, so that maybe they went somewhere else before they hit Flat Lake, but or Flathead. That was our first decon in Ontario last year. And you can see, if you can see behind that little the net there, that sometimes is all we see is a little mussel hidden in a crevice. That's what we're looking for. So it's important that these people pay attention to details and look these boats over thoroughly. This is 2015. In 8 days, we have intercepted 4 boats. One from Ohio with zebra mussels, one from Oklahoma with zebra mussels, one from Lake Mead with quaggas, and from Lake Havasu with quagga mussels. So right now Ontario gets the bragging rights. When a visitor comes to Oregon, these are the signs they'll see when they, and lets them know that the check station is open. And other states have these check stations, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho. So by the time they get to Oregon, they're well familiar with it. But it's important that more people look at it because they're really small and you can miss them. And several of our inspections were, boats have been previously inspected in another state and they just missed things. So we're kind of the tail end. So everybody's protecting each other. So this is required by law and ODOT. And so you'll see the boat inspection ahead, then required for all watercraft, and then directing them into the check station. This is our tentative schedule for 2015. This week, actually, the inspectors are in training. We did open Ontario early in March, and also the Ashland check station in March. And we'll go, most of them will stay open to mid-September or the end of October, our busier ones. And like I said, we're going to do Basque on a roving, send somebody there for a week at a time throughout the summer just to see what kind of volume we got and how we need to develop it. With that, this is one of our first one. I talked earlier about notification from other states. This boat was actually stopped in Idaho. They couldn't do a decon. Idaho called us, and we met him at a rest area there in La Grande and took care of his boat. And as you can see, those are quagga mussels in the little channel. And that was plugged full of quagga mussels when we intercepted his boat.
Wow.
So with that, we'll take any questions.
Thank you very much. I know that we've had quite a series of questions so far. Representative Esquivel.
Not really a question, Mr. Chair, but more of a statement that obviously we're woefully inadequate with our check stations. Anytime we have openings and anytime we have, I mean, boats just don't go through for 4 hours a day or 8 hours a day. They go through all the time. So we need to work on that as a state.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel. We have done through, this is our 6th season, and we vary the check stations and we keep track of the noncompliance. And when we get the most traffic, and we have found that between 10 and 3 o'clock is the majority of our traffic, so that's why we set up during that time period for the most part. But you're correct, they come in day and night.
And if you were to have more improved coverage, would it be hours of the day? Would it be specific locations, combination of both? What is it that, what would be the priorities that if we were to be able to expand your program, what would you expand to next?
Chair Witt, the next would be to keep all check stations open, at least daylight hours, so expand staff so that we'd cover it. And then cover the other holes on our southern boundaries, which is the Redwood Highway 199, and try to get somebody at Bass that would actually stay there. And so cover those. And then the next would be up, start moving up to the northern boundaries, up to Umatilla and those areas where you got boats coming across on 97 through Idaho, Montana, down through Washington. So combination of all those.
And so the highways that feed into Burns, they were less of a concern?
Sure. With at 95 at Basque, we intercept all of them. If they're coming through Idaho, we are hoping that Idaho stops in the Jordan Valley.
I see.
Jordan Valley is the only inspection station in the country that has 100% compliance rate because they have county officers working that station all the time.
Very good. Very good. Representative McEwen?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. Anyone else?
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. And with that, now it's time to call up Richard Whitman and Ryan Hoof.
You can probably open that public hearing if you want.
Are they here for the bill?
Yeah. Invasive Species Council appointment to the state invasive species
appearance. Gentlemen, would you hold off for a second? They're here specifically for this. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 209. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Again, Richard Whitman, Governor Brown's Natural Resource Advisor, pleased to be here this morning and pleased to follow that great presentation you heard, and really want to thank Lisa, Mark, Glenn, and Rick for the great work that they're doing on this program. We're here this morning to testify on Senate Bill 209, and I'm here today to tell you that I'm here to support Senate Bill 209. You heard from Lisa the importance of having a coordinated, comprehensive, prioritized, strategic invasive species program. Well, the Oregon Invasive Species Council is how we do that here in the state of Oregon. It's the body that brings together the state agencies and other partners who are working on all these different holes in the dike that represent the problems with invasive species. So Senate Bill 209 would make some small changes to the Oregon Invasive Species Council to strengthen the council. And more specifically, it would make appointment of the coordinator for the Oregon Invasive Species Council mandatory. Under current law, it's permissive for the council to appoint a coordinator. The coordinator position has been done under contract. There's not an FTE dedicated to it, and I think that's worked fairly well. And there also is a commitment behind this in terms of money. The proposed budget for the Oregon Department of Agriculture includes an increase of $100,000 in funding for the coordinator position to a total of $150,000, so that not only we make this a mandatory that we have a coordinator, but we also provide the funding to support that position. With that, I'd like to just mention two other things very briefly. Also indicate Governor's support for the Senate Joint Memorial 9, and thank you, Representative McEwen and Senator Roblin, who was here earlier, and other co-sponsors of that important memorial. We certainly support having more to funding be available for that purpose. And then finally, it was also mentioned in the prior testimony, the Western Governors Association does have a resolution on invasive species, and we are working on an update to that resolution to come before the Western Governors Association at their June meeting later this year. So with that, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is, for the record, my name is Ryan Hoof, and in addition to coordinating the state's ballast water management program that you've heard about in previous hearings, I also serve as DEQ's representative to the Oregon Invasive Species Council. In addition to 10 appointed members to the council that represent a breadth of stakeholder interests, the OISC also consists of 7 members that represent state natural resource agencies or universities who rotate the council officer duties on an annual basis. This year's council chair, Wyatt Williams from the Department of Forestry, was unable to attend today but has submitted a letter to the committee regarding Senate Bill 209 and has asked that I provide some additional testimony. The Invasive Species Council's mission is to protect Oregon's economy and natural resources by conducting a coordinated and thorough effort to keep invasive species out of our state and to eliminate, reduce, or mitigate the impacts of any invasive species that have become established. There are a wide variety of known invaders, including the Dreissena mussels you've heard about and things like emerald ash borer, that are not established in our state, but that are capable of inflicting or causing hundreds of millions of dollars in damages to our state's economy. I think you've gathered from previous presentations this morning that we have much to gain in our state by keeping these species out. Nationwide, invasive species have caused an estimated $120 billion annually in losses. Globally, these species are recognized as a leading cause of native species extinctions. They're responsible for altering ecosystem functioning and a decrease in natural resource productivity. First and foremost, we believe that preventing introductions to our state is paramount. This requires minimizing the transport of invasive species by various human-mediated pathways, and it also involves promoting early detection and rapid response capabilities. A variety of case studies have suggested that for every dollar invested in prevention efforts, we are saving between $20 and $40 in the cost to manage invasive species once they become established. When invasive species are established into the state, or introduced anyway, the OISC helps to leverage our member agencies and network of key stakeholders to achieve early detection and then to carry out quick and coordinated response to control or eradicate species before they become technically or financially impossible to manage. In addition to promoting outreach and education and providing a venue for communication amongst agencies and stakeholders, the OISC also helps identify priorities, emerging issues, and the need for stable funding to support existing invasive species management programs in the state, including but not limited to our noxious weed and pest management program, programs at Department of Agriculture and the Department of Forestry, the ballast water program at DEQ, and the recreational boat AIS prevention program that you heard about earlier from the State Marine Board and the Fish and Wildlife. Coordination is a primary function of the council and a critical component of our state's preparedness. In recent years, activities led by our council coordinator resulted in a great return on investment for the state. For example, between 2010 and 2014, while the state was contributing approximately $50,000 per biennium to help support the coordinator's position, the council's grant development efforts and ability to leverage funds from other sources resulted in roughly $300,000 per biennium in additional funds to support our state's outreach, our education, and coordination objectives. However, stable backing to fund the coordinator position has challenged the council's ability to attract and maintain qualified individuals in that role. In addition to elevating the importance of the council coordinator position, Senate Bill 209 also clarifies the voting rights of the 10 appointed members to the council. The existing statute is somewhat unclear on this point, and the bill, as introduced, aligns with the council's mission and validates our current operating practices. So to conclude, I and the council thank this committee for your consideration of this bill and more generally for your attention to the threats posed by invasive species. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And it's my understanding that this bill enjoyed a great deal of support over in the Senate side.
Unanimous.
Yeah. But that was only 30 votes, and we can do twice as good over here. So. Committee members.
Suspect of the bill.
Committee members, any questions or comments?
Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much.
And put it on the consent count.
You want to do that?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to, we've got a few people from the public who wanted to testify in this bill as well. Tom Wolf? And was there anyone else? Last call for public comment. Tom, you're carrying the whole state here for this morning.
I have broad shoulders. I can do it. Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, representing the Oregon Council of Tribal Limited. And about 12 years ago, I read a book called The Alien Invasion, and didn't concern the Texas-Mexican border, but concerned the invasion of non-native species into places all over the world. And it, let me tell you, it was a fairly, it's a very scary book, because it talks about habitat destruction is the biggest cause of demise of native species, but the invasion of non-native species is a second by a very slim margin. And scientists say that when species have been hurt by habitat destruction, when invasive species come in, they can lead to the eradication and destruction of that species. So it's of great concern. And Tribal Limited has been very active in this area of invasive species. In 2009, we were the lead conservation group in supporting the many invasive species bills that passed through that, including the setup of the boat inspection station. We got the conservation community on board with that. In 2011, we helped with a mandatory stoppage at the invasive species. In fact, one of the kindest things I've ever had is when Representative Jensen, who was the sponsor of the bill at the time, said that he never thought he'd see the day that he and Tom Wolf at Trout Unlimited would be on the same side, but they were on this bill. So I think that this is an issue that is of great concern to our state. You have my testimony on the list, which is completely different from this testimony, but that's par for the course. I think two things we need to address in this state. We need more funding to fund. We need more than five boat inspection stations, as Representative Esquivel pointed out. We need every place that boats can enter in the state covered. We need more staff so that this can be done 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. We need more funding for other programs. I mean, I know that that's not part of what this committee does, but I think this committee can really be a lead on improving what we do, getting more money for invasive species, and getting more staffing for invasive species. So Trout Unlimited supports both bills, we think that both the thing that needs to be done now is to increase the power of the Oregon Invasive Species Council, and which would be helped by having a mandatory hiring of a coordinator and eventually making it a more powerful body in and of itself, and asking the federal government for funding to help us with the vast discrepancy we have between what we have and what we need. So I urge that both of these bills be passed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Wolf? Not seeing any. Tom, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. A last and final call for public testimony on Senate Bill 209. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 209, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial Number 9. Mr. Gallagher, can you tell us a little bit about this bill? Memorial.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Joint Memorial Number 9 urges Congress to expedite appropriation of funds to enhance efforts to monitor and prevent spread of aquatic invasive species and to implement the Water Resources Reform and Development Act.
Good morning, Representative Boone. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Chair Witt and committee. I was just going to text my
buddy and sidekick, Senator Roblin, who is joined on this bill with me, among others, in our Coastal Caucus. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, and I've come to talk to you about Senate Joint Memorial 9, which is a great, the last bill was a great segue into this. And I just wanted to say that one of the things that always occurs to me in this sector is for about $5 million, our federal government, and this is just a rant, so take it for what it's worth, for about $5 million, the federal government could set up a perimeter on Lake Mead and solve this problem at its source. And I'm talking about quagga mussels that get on the boats and travel. Senator Roblin has a visual aid for you to show you what they look like and what they can do. And here he comes, just
That's
like
right.
that. So we each had a version of this bill, and mine was, I think it was HCR 17 or something. We decided since they were the same language, we would combine them into one bill, and since my compadre here is the upper class Senate, he got to use his bill. But this is supported across the board by so many people. In our group, Penwer, of which Oregon is a member, Pacific Northwest Economic Region, five states and five Canadian provinces and territories. This is a huge issue. We've been studying this for some time. Everybody in this, in the whole Northwest quadrant of North America, including the Canadians too, which now they have seen this mussel come into Winnipeg, Lake Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And so it's gone across the border. It's headed toward, it's everywhere on the East Coast. It's headed toward the Northwest, and we want to stop it. Even our colleagues in Alaska have been working with us because these things can live for 30 days out of water. And, oh, you brought the piece there. So we strongly recommend that you do whatever you can, including this. This is a memorial to Congress asking for funding to nip this in the bud, so to speak. But this is a big deal. And just a week or so ago, I think it was an Ontario station found quagga mussels on a boat that had transferred from Ohio. So I know you can cross the country in just a few days. If you, if you've had your boat in water and got a hold of one, one can do it. They lay a million eggs a year, each one. It's a tiny little thing. So I will turn this over to my colleague, Senator Roblin, now, and we're going to be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Senator Roblin, welcome to our committee. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Witt and the rest of the committee. For the record, Arnie Roblin, District Senate District 5. This has been on my radar for a long time because I've been watching it kind of come across the country. We were in a special place. Oregon was surrounded by states that didn't have any, so we thought that was pretty good protection for a while. And then they came to California. And just so people know, the piece of stuff you have there is a piece of irrigation pipe from a good senator in Idaho who rented a dock space on Lake Mead and took license plates and pieces of irrigation pipe and dropped them in the lake. This one 15 months, and so people could understand what the problem was. Idaho was one of the first states to start putting a passport, so when you come in, you can check your passport that your boat was clean and all these other kinds of stuff. They figured out a way to try to help protect their borders. Oregon came about with, as you know, we passed a fee for a non-motorized watercraft, and that has helped fund cleaning stations and other things. We changed our police. There was a time when our state patrol would find a boat that may be infested, and we encouraged them to go to Washington because they had a they had a cleaning station. We didn't have that stuff. We've become much more active, and you're going to hear from people later. So one of the things that we worked on was the WERDA bill, which is the Water Resources Reform Act, Development Act, back in D.C. a few years ago, 2013. Dredging, a whole bunch of stuff are in the WERDA bill. It was very important to the coast. But one of the little pieces in the WERDA bill was an authorization for $20 million for the Columbia Basin to work with Corps of Engineers to keep cleaning stations and keep quaggas out of the Columbia system. So it was authorized, but you have to also appropriate it.
There's two processes in the federal process. So what our bill does here, what our resolution does, is to say we want to appropriate that $20 million so that the Corps of Engineers can work with the Bonneville Association to start coming up with ways in which they can help protect and ensure that we don't get them into our system. For those who don't understand, this came, we believe, from ballast water, from the Baltic area. They are indigenous there. They don't grow too much. They don't have a lot of calcium in their water, so natural conditions keep their population down. Came in, they can live for a long time, forever probably, in some of these bilged areas because there's nothing affecting them. The larvae get in, they come over, we drop them in the Great Lakes, and then we've watched their growth go from that point on. They've gone down the Mississippi, back up the Missouri. I mean, they are an amazing species. The Columbia River Basin is high in calcium. Things like the dams are made out of calcium, if you really think about where cement comes from and other stuff. So what will happen if we don't keep them out, and there have not been any successful getting them out once they were there, or very few. A couple places where the lake had no water coming in, no lake going out, just a big hole in the ground. They have killed everything, and they've killed them. But when it comes to in water, say, deals like rivers or lakes, we have not been successful. They tried in Canada, thought they had taken care of it, found out they took care of the little harbor that it was in, but they had gotten out already. And so we need to take it seriously when they get in. Anybody that's trying to take water out of a river, a stream, or a lake are going to get that kind of problem in their irrigation pipes. The dams have to spend a lot of money cleaning up. All the water districts have to spend enormous amounts of money. They figure a couple $100 million a year annually or more just to keep up with it, because you aren't getting rid of them. You're just an ongoing maintenance problem. I really encourage you to encourage the federal government to spend the money they've appropriated, I mean that they have set out there for us, and appropriate it so that we can actually start working with the Corps on the Columbia to make it better. And you'll hear from some of the experts that I see sitting behind me. If you have any other questions, we'd be glad to, after I know more about this little guy than I had anticipated knowing when I came here. But any questions you might have, encourage you to pass this bill.
Thank you very much. Anything from the committee? Vice Chair McLean, please.
We heard from the experts before you guys came in here, so I feel like I can get a degree in this today. I feel like that all during our informational sessions all the time, there's just so much information. But you guys were absolutely the best coordinated informational group we've had because we got reinforcement on all the major points and the everything. I'm voting yes.
Okay. They are, you know, the little piece I've had a lot of comments about, it's kind of like a work of art. It's awfully interesting. And these are the little guys. You know, the bigger the zebra mussels, a bit larger. So there's not a lot of meals. Somebody asked me if there are any meals. Not a lot. But there are, and the million babies a year just make it remarkable to me. And make it easy to understand why you can't get rid of them. I mean, they just, one of those little guys. The fact that they can climb on each other and use that as the platform to build it's a pretty impressive little organism that shouldn't be here.
He already testified. Anything further? Seeing none, thank you both so very, very much for this exceedingly important memorial.
Thank you.
Anyone else from the public who would like to testify at this point on Senate Joint Memorial number 9? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 9 and open a work session on Senate Joint Memorial number 9. Committee members, are there any questions or comments about this memorial before I recognize Representative Krieger? I'm not seeing any. Vice Chair Krieger?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move SJM 9 to the floor of the DUPAS recommendation.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Krieger moves Senate Joint Memorial 9 to the floor with a DUPAS recommendation. Is there any discussion on his motion? I'm not seeing any. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Gorsuch.
Excused.
Representative McEwen.
Aye.
Representative Woodset.
Excused.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Vice Chair McLean.
Aye.
Chair Witt.
Aye. Having received the majority vote, the motion passes. And Representative Boone, would you like to carry this to the floor? Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Joint Memorial 9. Committee members, you'll notice that we passed out a halftime report on the bills that came out of this committee. It's a rather extensive list. I think it's something that we can all be proud of with the very significant amount of work that we accomplished here. Thank you all for your help with that. And is there anything else for the good of the order at this point? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday I was looking on my computer and they were showing 10 devastating things in the world that have affected the environment. And I was very dismayed on, I think it was MSN that put this on, that they took a picture of one of our lakes that had dropped down, as you could see the layers on the sides, and these stumps were there, and their theme was, we've devastated our forest through logging. And I think that's so inappropriate, and I think it's so dishonest.
Yes.
That, I mean, it was so obvious what that was, but you take somebody that's never been around a lake that sees those stumps, and all they see is these stumps, they think, my God, they're cutting everything. Well, it's just very unfortunate that we have some people out there in the media that enjoy being dishonest.
Well,
amen.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Esquivel, and happen to be aware of ongoing commentary on some of the bills that came out of this committee that have received similar treatment by a local media organization.
Yes.
And their journalistic integrity leaves something to be desired. So anything further for the good of the order? Seeing none, thank you, committee members, very, very much, not only for today, but again, for the extensive amount of work that is represented here in these couple of pages. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Adjourned.